everybody. This is B. Solomon Baltapara here with you again for Conversations in the Dark here in the Vaultcast. And this week we're going to be talking about comic books. And of course, as you can probably tell from the name of my blog, I am a bit of a fan of horror comics. And we're going to be talking about that a little bit this week. And I'm very pleased to be speaking on that subject with none other than Brian White of Cinema Suicide. A lot of you may know that site. If you don't know it, you should check it out. It's cinema-suicide.com, and it's a terrific blog. And I'd like to welcome Brian here to talk about comics and other stuff tonight. How's it going?
Not bad. How are you doing?
Pretty good, actually. We should probably fill some people in on the fact that we kind of got into this back and forth obsessive discussion of 70s horror comics, which is really where this whole idea came from. Because we were really looking for an outlet to kind of take this comic geek discussion that we were having and turn it into something that other people could maybe listen in on. So I'm glad that we're doing this.
Yeah. Originally it was a huge production I was trying to put together. I just could not get it together. I'm glad that we're actually doing this.
Well, no, it's hard. You know, the more people, too, you try to get involved, the harder it gets to get everybody's schedule freed up and everything. I know originally we were going to do something like this for Cinema Suicide, and I just figured since it didn't work out, might as well bring it over here and do it. I mean, there's no need to leave it to collect dust, because, I mean, I'm still the way this started, actually, was I recently picked up a collected softcover edition of Man-Thing comics from Marvel, and it reminded me of how much I was interested in that character and how much I was interested in that whole 70s era of Marvel horror comics. And I even wound up doing – I was inspired to do a whole column just about the Man-Thing for another site that I write for, the Bloodsprayer, because I just felt like nobody really talks about this character enough. It just kind of fascinates me.
Yeah, when you brought it up, I actually – It occurred to me that I actually didn't really know anything about Man-Thing. Like, when I first started buying comics, I was probably like 13, so this would have been like 1988 or 89. And I would go to the comic store and I'd buy all the monthlies that I followed, but whatever I had left over from my allowance, I'd spend on back issues. And I always sprung for the horror comics. Like some of the first ones I bought were like Werewolf by Night and Ghost Rider. And I remember seeing those Man-Thing books and thinking, man, that looks so lame. and then just recently I came around to it. Like I eventually found my way to Swamp Thing, and it just kind of made sense to follow up on Man-Thing. And I was delighted to find that it's a great book. I mean, it's totally underrated.
It really is. It's funny, you know, I always felt, you know, I was tempted to think the same thing because Marvel never has really pushed that character or done too much with it, and I almost feel like it's because of Swamp Thing. I mean, they both started at the same time, and for whatever reason, Swamp Thing has always been, you know, the cooler character. I don't know if it's because he talks, I don't know. But
I think it really has a lot to do more with the Alan Moore run on it.
Yeah, maybe.
Because if you ever read those Len Wein books, they're pretty awful.
Yeah.
The early Swamp Thing is tough to really... grasp. I actually feel like Man-Thing is the superior book because, I mean, it's such a strange comic.
Yeah.
And it has all this, like, since the character doesn't speak, there's like, and his face isn't terribly expressive. I mean, it's really a much more, I guess, like an introspective comic, if you want to think of it that way, where, you know, Swamp Thing had him grappling with robots in a machine city that somehow exists in the continuity of the DC universe. So, I mean, it was like one was really silly and the other was really strange and hard to kind of get your mind around. I think that was really the failing of Man-Thing. But, I mean, clearly the Alan Moore run on Swamp Thing is kind of what puts it firmly in mind of a lot of comic fans because those books are amazing.
Well, Man-Thing started off right. I mean, like you said, it took a while for Swamp Thing to come into his own as a character, and it really didn't happen until the 80s. But yeah. Man-Thing, right out of the gate, as a matter of fact, probably that early stuff is still the best stuff that's ever been done with that character. And I think it's because it was during those horror days where they put a lot more effort into those books. It just, Jerry Conway was one of the co-creators and just very surreal. And like you said, I guess that's maybe why it didn't totally catch on. He never really had his own book that lasted more than like a year or two. But there's just so much bizarre stuff. Those early issues, there's just, it feels very subversive, you know, like there's bikers and weird counterculture stuff going on, and the kind of stuff you didn't really see too much, even in Marvel, which was always pushing the boundaries. There was a lot of political commentary on the Vietnam War and Nixon and things like that. It's unusual, you know?
Right. It was kind of a character out of place. Like, I think Man-Thing probably would have really flown in the late 60s, because that was really when the Jim Steranko run on Nick Fury and Silver Surfer and Doctor Strange were a really big deal. And those books are bizarre, like just so strange. I mean, right down, everything about them is just... It seems like they were conceived over bong rips.
Oh, there's no... I mean, for some of these things, let me tell you, there's a... I don't know. Do you have the... Did you pick up that volume one of the Essential Man thing that I have?
I have the complete run okay. of Man oh, Thing wow. and like a bunch of like side appearances and like also rants. So. Okay.
Well, there's, you know, in one of the issues, for example, a jar of peanut butter. Do you know what I'm talking about? It transforms into like this ancient barbarian guy. And it's just the most, and it's played dead serious. Dead serious. It's the most bizarre thing you'll ever see in a comic book. Like, it's insanity. And you know what? There's an artist, too, actually. Obviously, I don't want to spend the whole time just talking about Man-Thing, but I love it so much. There's an artist named Mike Ploog.
Mike Ploog is everywhere in the 70s.
Oh, good God. I got to really love his stuff from Man-Thing. And then I later found out that he was actually one of the artists, kind of the storyboard artists and character designers for the Heavy Metal movie.
You could really see it a lot also. I mean, the style of that movie, just the general art vibe of the whole thing. I mean, it really does look like 70s Marvel.
He did Conan too for a little while in the 70s. The thing that's cool about him though, I mean, I guess some people might call it a weakness. I just think it's kind of charming because it's probably the same thing I would do, is you could tell he's a fantastic artist because like the way he draws Man-Thing and all the weird creatures and stuff is just so, I don't know, there's just something about it. It's just ahead of its time and really, really creative. But then whenever he's drawing anything else, like regular people and buildings and vehicles and stuff, it's just you could totally tell he's just rushing through it and just wants to get it over.
The guy was probably drawing 4 books a month.
Oh, yeah. I mean, and those, you know what, too? And this is where you know, I sound like crotchety old comics guy. They met their deadline like clockwork every damn month. And I mean, it was brilliant, brilliant stuff. They didn't keep you waiting 3 months for the next issue because the guy was, you know, trying to perfect every panel. You know, I mean, it was different, but whatever.
Yeah.
I get all grumbly about that stuff. But yeah, horror comic, the 70s, I think we could agree, is just sort of like this high point for horror comics. I guess Marvel in particular. I'm not too sure about what DC was doing then.
DC never really seemed to catch the horror comic thing. The Comics Code Authority kind of eased its restrictions against horror books. Because, I mean, that was really what the code was established to do, was really put the kibosh on horror comics. Because EC Comics was really the kind of the big bad in the 50s. And specifically, they targeted horror comics. And I mean, they were really very explicit about what you could and couldn't do. Like, I mean, specifically, you could not do vampire comics. There's something just so appalling about vampires to the Comics Code suits that you just couldn't get away with it. And then in 1971, they eased up their restrictions because Marvel published a comic without the code's authority stamp. You know, like all those comics had that logo on them.
Yep.
But they did it without it. It was a comic that involved drug use. It was actually against drug use. It was a Spider-Man book.
Oh yeah, with Harry Osborn, right? The LSD storyline. Yeah.
Yeah, and the code would not approve it, and so Marvel went ahead and published it anyways, and nothing. There was no real repercussions. And I mean, that was really sort of the beginning of the end for the authority. And in order to kind of stay relevant, they had to rewrite the rules, which meant easing up on horror comics. And that just opened the floodgates for Marvel because the following year they launched like 4 horror comics.
And yet for some reason it didn't last. But when I first started, like, you know, coming across these comics, I guess like you, it was his back issues. I would pick up Tomb of Dracula, or the Defenders had a lot of weird, creepy horror stuff in it. And I was interested in that. But by the time I was collecting, by the time I started in the mid 80s, pretty much totally superhero stuff. I mean, there wasn't that much stuff to be found that was new, you know?
Right.
I didn't really start seeing a lot of horror comics pop up till the 90s, and it wasn't even in the big two companies. It was, you know, it was outside stuff, like Spawn kind of had a little bit of that flavor to it. And I remember there was a great zombie comic in the 90s. I've seen it collected too. I forget what it was called. I think it was called Dead World.
Dead World. I mean, Dead World was actually running in the 80s.
Oh, God, was it?
Okay. It's kind of an old book. It was one of those, like, I remember when I used to buy comics, I'd buy it at a comic store. The direct market always had the indie books. Yes. And the indies were where it was at. I mean, that was like where, like, the really gritty, dark stuff was happening. Like, they didn't have the money for four colors, so everything was in black and white. And it was always extremely gory. And Dead World was one of those titles. And then else was there? It was later in the 90s. There was a really, really twisted nuts one called Faust.
Yes, yes.
Yeah, but it was Brian Usna, I think, directed a movie, either directed or produced a movie based on it. It's awful. It's completely terrible. But I mean, it's just like, it was one of those books that if you'd ever read it, it kind of stuck with you just because of how twisted it was. But yeah, the indie publishing scene is where a lot of the horror stuff took flight. And I'd say about 10% of it was actually any good. But Dead World was definitely one of them. It was probably one of the first zombie comics I ever saw.
Yeah, I was pretty amazed by it. And I've got to say, it's sort of funny. Zombies are just, in general, they just seem to be the thing that everybody likes to take their shot at. And most of it is really bad. It's almost like the same rule that applies to movies. You know what I mean? There's so many. There's a billion of them. And you could take the top 1%. And it's all you'd ever want to see. And it's the same with comics. God, I mean, even, you know, in the last decade, since the zombie movies have been so popular, I got to say, I mean, there have been, you know, The Walking Dead is head and shoulders above everything else. There's been so much, and even that I have my problems with as it moved along. But, I mean, there is some terrible stuff, some zombie-related stuff that's just unreadable. I would say between Dead World and Walking Dead, I mean, there isn't really much to speak of in between those two as far as zombie books go.
Most of it's forgettable. Like, off the top of my head, I can really only think of those two, I mean, which just kind of goes to prove the point.
Well, there was one that I saw that it was just, I mean, of course, somebody who probably going to get an email from the guy who wrote the thing or whatever, but when I forget what it was called, but the gimmick of it was that Barbara from Night of the Living Dead had somehow miraculously survived the end of that movie, and she went on to become like, you know, almost like Sarah Connor in Terminator 2. Like, she was she was the total opposite. She became like the Barbara of the remake, you know? They made her this total
turning point.
Yes, they made her this total sex pot, though. Where, like, I mean, it was laughable, and the art is like this total, like, Rob Liefeld type, completely over the top ridiculousness. And yeah, I bought one, and it's like that every time I pick up one of these. And I was afraid that was going to happen with Walking Dead, but it sucked me right in.
Oh yeah, the thing is, I get so jaded, you know, because I mean, as it stands, I see so many of these movies, and I'm just like at this point where I'm just like, there's no reason that I need to watch another zombie movie because it's just not going to be any good. And the same goes for comics. And for that reason, I actually passed up The Walking Dead for a good 30 issues. Like, a friend of mine eventually caught up with me, and he's like, "Oh man," he started talking about it as though I read it. Like, I'm automatically going to be reading The Walking Dead. And I told him, I was like, I've read the first couple issues, and I thought that it committed a couple of zombie crimes that I just couldn't get over. And he's like, "You really need to think about that again because it's a great book." And after that, he lent me this hardcover that I think collected like 26 issues of it. And I was like, I can't believe that I didn't read this from the start.
Oh yeah, I've seen that one. I started reading it, you know, issue by issue, and I was blown away, especially in the beginning. You know, I read it for the first 3 years. I probably read it during the exact period in which you weren't reading it. they lost their their artist Tony Moore in the beginning, and I've said this before, and that was just a crushing blow for me. Like,
it took a long time for me to get used to Charlie Adler's art. Yeah. And I eventually came to appreciate it. But that early, those, like, I think it's the first six or seven issues that he did that are
six. Yeah.
Yeah. That those books, the art in that is just so detailed, so amazing. I mean, that's what really hooked me.
It's not even that Charlie Adler is the worst artist in the world or anything. It's just, it just pisses me off so much to think of what it could have been. You know what I mean? Like, as good as the writing is with Tony Moore's art, it just would have been a lot better, I hate to say. I mean, like, every panel he did was the quality of a cover. You know what I mean?
Right.
It was on, it was great stuff, and for whatever happened. I mean, I read it for about 3 years. I felt like it got a little bit soapy, and a, it started losing me a bit. Maybe I'm just kind of dense and I need more zombie action. But
I got a friend who I have a bunch of friends. And we always talk about this, and each one of them dislikes it for a different reason. And like one guy really can't stand it because it'll go 7 issues without a zombie.
Yes.
And another guy just thinks it is so unrelentingly bleak that he can't stand to read it because he's just like, he wants to kill himself at the end of every issue.
Well, it is. It's like a zombie movie that never ends. You know,
it really is. And I mean, I guess that's the point. Like I got to the end of issue 48, which is sort of the resolution of the prison arc. Everybody knows that one. Who's kept up with it when the governor raids the jail, just how that arc ended. And I remember this is one full page, just a single panel at the end. And I hate to be spoilery, so I won't say what it is. But like if anybody who knows what I'm talking about knows what I'm talking about. So this was a point where I finally kind of put the book down and was like, do I really, really need to read this comic?
Yes, I know what you're – I mean, I wasn't reading anymore at that point, but I do know what you're referring to, and I'm not going to – I don't want to get into it, but yeah, definitely. I mean
– yeah, it's definitely like it's just – it's I like after that, I'm like, where is he going to go with this?
But it's funny because we are kind of in a time now where I'd have to say the last 10 years have been better for horror comics than any time since the 70s. I mean, they're all over. The 30 Days of Night had a lot to do with that too. That's another big one. But I mean, there hasn't been – in the 70s, it almost seemed that Marvel was almost – I can't confirm this, and I'm probably wrong. But you almost get the feeling that they were toying with the idea of moving away from superheroes completely and just doing more kind of weird fantasy type stuff, you know?
You definitely get that idea because if you look at their lineups, there's a Marvel wiki out there which is so detailed. It'll show you monthly what books came out. And at this period, about 1972 to about 1979, they had their tentpole books. You had the Uncanny X-Men and Amazing Spider-Man. You had Captain America and the Avengers. Basically, the big titles were still selling very well. But I guess Marvel had a really hard time towards the late 70s, and I guess they were lucky to get the Star Wars license.
Oh, yeah.
And I guess the Star Wars book really kind of saved the company, but even their superhero books weren't doing so well. And I think that this period in the 70s was a sort of readjustment, like what kind of a comics company are we? Because obviously these superhero books aren't doing so well. So yeah, like the bulk of their publishing at that time, easily the majority of it was all of these weirdo genre books.
Well, yeah, it seemed like they were trying to capitalize on a lot of the exploitation stuff that was going on in the 70s, because you also find a lot of kung fu related books happening, and like
you had Iron Fist
and you
Shang-Chi.
You also had Luke Cage, who was clearly like the blaxploitation capitalizing.
Right, he was like Shaft.
He was the superhero version of a blaxploitation character. But see, that's the funny thing. It almost seemed like they were still in the same mindset. They were trying to do different things, but it was still set up like a superhero comic. You'll notice every horror comic they do, it's not really like an EC-style horror comic. It's like it's built around a superhero-like character, even though it's horror. Like they did a Frankenstein comic, but Frankenstein Monster was almost like a superhero, you know?
Actually, it was a lot like Captain America in a lot of ways. Winds up frozen and then unfrozen in the modern times.
They had a zombie guy, you know.
Tales of the Zombie.
And Dracula was, I mean, he crossed over into the Marvel Universe. I remember being really confused by that as a kid.
There's a couple of Uncanny X-Men where all of a sudden Dracula's in the continuity. I'm like, I think I saw those back issues when I had them in like those classic X-Men comics. And I'm like, what is Dracula doing in this book?
Well, they were also fighting Godzilla. That was very confusing to me.
Oh, yeah, they had giant, like, mecha robos, too, yes, for, like, all those Japanese animations.
But they brought them all in. They somehow did it. And Dracula, I mean, I applauded them, and I guess they had to do this. But they did their best to make him look very different from, you know, the Dracula that people would think. You know, he didn't look like Christopher Lee. He didn't look like like Bela Lugosi. He was a distinctive Marvel Dracula, and he actually looked a lot like the way he's described in the novel, which I thought was
right. Well, actually, I asked Marv Wolfman this, and one of the things I was really hoping to get was a little bit of insight about the movie connection, because it really, with a lot of these characters, it seems very clear that they were seeing these movies and they're going, oh man, we got to work that into the comic. But I asked Marv Wolfman about this, and he said that when he took over the book, he had never actually seen Dracula. And the only sort of reference he had for it while he was writing the character was a Bram Stoker novel.
Hmm. Well, there you go. And where?
So there.
I guess that explains it.
Yeah, yeah.
You also had Werewolf by Night, which was another one that I remember that one actually having a little more staying power. I remember that character persisting really into well beyond that era of horror comics. He didn't have his own book, but he would pop up a lot more, I think, than the other ones did for whatever reason.
For some reason, he always seemed to show up in Iron Man.
Yeah, and I think doesn't he show up in the McFarlane run of Spider-Man in the early 90s at some point? For some reason, I feel like he did.
Yeah, Todd McFarlane was, when he was sort of had creative control over those books, he tended to tie a lot of the horror characters back into it. I think he also used like Moon Knight a couple of times, mm-hmm. who came from the Werewolf by Night book. Dracula would show up in whatever he happened to be writing.
Yes, and well, obviously, too, you have to mention the one character who I feel like really kind of crossed over more than any others, who started as a horror character and just became one of the mainstream superheroes, has got to be Ghost Rider.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, Ghost Rider. I can't really explain it, but my first introduction to Ghost Rider was that Mark Teixeira series that they did in 1990.
Yeah.
And I still maintain that like the first four issues of that book are some of the best horror comics I've ever read. I mean, it is such a dark comic. And it actually, that spurred me to look back at the original Ghost Riders. Remember, I was in the comic store, I was buying books at the time, and I was just going through the back issues, and I saw like this large chunk of a box just dedicated to Ghost Rider. I started lifting them out, and I'm like, these look a little cheesy. You know, I'm like 14 years old at the time, but I bought a bunch of them, and I just couldn't have been happier.
Yeah, see, I had, well, that's the thing. At that age, like, you're almost too young to appreciate the cheesiness. Like, you know, teenagers.
Like these days, I've got the perspective to really appreciate it. But, I mean, like, looking back at the time, I'm like, what is up with this blue jumpsuit?
Well, teenage boys just have no sense of irony or humor. They're just very, they're very grave and serious. The older I get, the more I find that to be the case. They just need to loosen up a little bit. But, and I, myself included, as I think back. Many, many years, but Ghost Rider, I had heard of, I was familiar with him, but by the time I was starting to collect, the character was kind of dead. Nothing, I mean, they weren't doing anything. So the first time that I really got to read him, yeah, it was that revamp where they had Danny Ketch instead of Johnny Blaze. And I was, you know, I love the fact that Danny Ketch was from Brooklyn, because I was from Brooklyn. So I'm reading the book, and yeah, it was really cool the way they did it, and the art is, yeah, it's Mark Teixeira and also Javier Saltarez, who was amazing, and
they both had this really great distinctive style, that kind of like rough, sketchy look.
Mm-hmm.
He did it. Teixeira did a bunch of like Punisher War journals also that I really clung to. Like pretty much anything that guy did in the 90s was something I was into. See, which is unusual, because usually, like, I'm a writer, so I don't really care too much for like an art print. Like the presentation layer of a comic book doesn't really mean as much to me as the script.
Mm-hmm.
But whenever he was in charge, I just loved that stuff.
Yeah, I mean, they did a lot of really interesting things there, I thought, and it was kind of interesting how they almost tried to turn it into like a whole corner of the Marvel Universe. If you remember the Midnight Suns, and they brought Johnny Blaze back into the storyline and everything like that.
Is that just sort of like burned out?
Yes.
Drunk at the time.
That's right. I think that was the inspiration.
Sort of ends on a very ambiguous note. I think he shakes off the demon that's kind of bonded to him, and it just sort of leaves him in tatters. So I guess this kind of rough road that he'd been traveling for the rest of his life was really most appropriate.
Well, I think that had to be the inspiration, I really do think, for what they did with the character in the movie version, where Nicolas Cage is, it's like they combined both, you know what I mean? They carried over, I mean, obviously, Nicolas Cage must have lobbied hard to play this part, and they had to come up with an explanation as to why Johnny Blaze is old.
Right.
But I feel like they really drew a lot from, like, that middle-aged, burnt-out Johnny Blaze of those 90s Ghost Rider books.
That's right.
It felt like they did anyway.
Yeah, I definitely got that feeling. I mean, the movie is terrible, but, I guess it's the closest thing we're going to get to a Ghost Rider movie, which is too bad, because I think the character is so great. Like, of all of those sort of horror books that Marvel did, Ghost Rider was one of my favorites.
Well, that's the one that persisted. You know, I always think it's really odd how it really seems for some reason that the majority of books and characters who have had any legs and have been able to sustain their own books for year after year after year, for some reason at Marvel, they were all created in the 60s. If you think about it, even till today, there's only a handful of characters beyond the 60s. I mean, Wolverine obviously being the first one that comes to mind, who are at that same level. And I mean, Ghost Rider out of the horror guys is the closest thing, even though even that character has not been popular enough to sustain a book, you know, year after year after year. He kind of comes and goes, but he's definitely the most popular of those horror ones.
I'd say a good contender for that is also the Punisher. Yes. He was created in 1974.
Definitely.
And he persisted mostly through the 70s as basically a backup character in, like, Amazing Spider-Man and Daredevil. The Frank Miller run on Daredevil used to weave the Punisher into it a lot. Then he got his own series in, I think, 1985.
Something like that.
Yep. And then from there, it was just he just went until they started really messing with him in the 90s. I think he was an angel at one point.
Yes, that's right. Well, he was killed.
A jacket full of guns. He was a black guy at some point.
Well, I know he was killed, wasn't he?
He was killed.
Yeah,
that's
Nick
right.
Fury killed then, him, I think.
Garth Ennis brought him back as if it never happened. And somebody says to the Punisher in one of the books, "I heard you died once." He's like, "Yeah, I don't like to talk about that."
That's fantastic. And there's another movie that just really just missed the mark. Although, I mean, I can't imagine.
Which one, though?
I don't know what the point was of doing a Punisher movie, because quite honestly, you know, it's funny. Like, we talk about how Marvel was capitalizing on all these exploitation subgenres, right? So you had Kung Fu, you had Blaxploitation, you had exploitation horror. And with Punisher, you get, like, the revenge vigilante movies, Death Wish, Dirty Harry.
Right. I always get the timeline confused, but the Punisher appears in an issue of The Amazing Spider-Man, and he's actually sort of a secondary antagonist to this character called the Jackal.
Mm-hmm.
But only a couple of months after that book was published, Death Wish was released in theaters. And it was really sort of the prevailing vibe. Like, there was a series of novels called The Executioner, which sort of follows a very similar narrative, where it's basically like guy on the street just killing mobsters out of revenge. I mean, it was sort of a real sort of common sentiment, I guess, in the city at the time.
Yeah, I guess so. It was almost, yeah, it was really of the time, people kind of losing faith and losing patience with you know, kind of organized law and order and things like that. I guess it was just something that was happening. But like I'm saying, you know, with the Punisher, the idea, I mean, obviously the idea is to make money, but from a creative standpoint, the idea of doing a Punisher movie to me is silly, because the Punisher is kind of a derivative of all those movies that already existed. So you make a movie and it just winds up coming off as a cheap knockoff of the
It's almost like, yeah, it's like been filtered through a filter.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, the Punisher was already, you know, a watered down version of these R-rated vigilante movies. So why do you make a movie out of that? It's I don't know. It's just very, very derivative. So, I mean, I wasn't surprised that neither one of those movies hit the mark at all.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Well, you got that one in 1989, that one with Dolph Lundgren, which is like barely a Punisher movie.
And Lou Gossett Jr., yeah.
Yeah.
He doesn't even wear the skull shirt. I mean, it's just, it's not even the Punisher.
Yeah. I have friends who absolutely love that movie, though. I can't understand it, but, you know, they're welcome to it. Then the one with Thomas Jane is also god-awful, though I love the ending.
Now, in the one with Thomas Jane, doesn't he have, which one is the one where he actually has the guy in the truck that helps him out?
That was the recent one where Warzone.
Because that's a great character. I always thought they should have used him, you know?
Oh, yeah, Microchip.
Yeah, did you ever... You know who reminded me of that? Again, it's like you see these things pop up and you think these guys had to be reading comics. Tom Arnold's character in True Lies is that guy.
Definitely. He definitely is. I swear to God. Like, all of these guys were reading comics at the time. Like, in Day of the Dead, there's a total nod to Wolverine where there's the character Dr. Logan. He's the mad scientist. And then his zombie pet is named Bub.
Which I didn't make that connection, as ridiculous as that sounds, until possibly this year. I mean, because I just rewatched it, and I'm like, holy shit, why did I never realize this?
Yeah. And then in the 90s, Roger Corman, and I think was actively pursuing The Amazing Spider-Man with Jim Cameron. So, I mean, the Cameron connection to comic books is just undeniable. It's totally there.
I always think of what that Cameron Spider-Man movie would have been like.
Oh, I know.
And I mean,
I think they had Charlie Sheen wanted to be Spider-Man also. I mean, that would have just been nuts.
I mean, I like the way it turned out. I really do like the first two a lot, you know. And I mean, I guess there's a chance that it could have been really great. There's a chance that it could have been awful. I mean, I don't know. I don't know who would have really done it justice. And the special effects at that time were just not ready. I remember as a kid even thinking in my head, you know, there's no way I could imagine any way in a movie that you could represent the kinds of things that are in that book, you know, because there was no concept of CGI or anything like that.
That's right.
How are you going to show a guy in free, you know, in 360, you know, open space swinging through Manhattan? It's just impossible.
Yeah. Well, I know Roger Corman, his production company at the time, during the, I think in the early 90s, owned a lot of the Marvel properties. Since Marvel wasn't terribly concerned with who was sort of representing them on screen, which just kind of explains how that first Punisher came about. But had you ever seen the Corman version of the Fantastic Four?
You know, I have avoided, I think, out of just dread. I've seen the Punisher. I've avoided that, and I've avoided the Captain America.
Oh, man, that Albert Pyun flick is just unforgivable.
I can't even believe it. I remember at the time reading Starlog magazine, which was our version of the internet at that time.
That's right, is that Fango?
And looking and seeing, is this real? Is this a joke? You know, I mean, even by the unsophisticated standards of that I had at that time, I'm looking, I'm thinking, all right, this guy looks like somebody just stuck a giant A to his forehead. He's got fake ears. I mean, what is this? And the thing... You know, I mean, well, the Fantastic Four, the whole thing was just like, I'm looking at it and I'm like, because I saw stills and stuff and I couldn't believe what I was seeing. You know, it was almost like it was like a joke. It was almost, it looked like a parody.
Yeah, the Fantastic Four is monumentally terrible. Like the Punisher really only hints at just how bad things could get. But like there was, I guess they made the movie because they were at threat of losing the option. And so they had to do something before, I guess, time was up.
Hmm.
And so they made this movie with no intention of actually releasing it. And then, of course, I mean, it winds up getting out there. And you get to see it. And the special effects are god-awful. To its credit, the Thing costume and the Doctor Doom costumes are fantastic.
That's what I've heard.
The Human Torch doesn't actually flame on until the very end of the movie.
Hmm.
And it is really, really bad. Like, really bad.
Yeah, that's kind of what I've heard.
But yeah, that's just how it goes, I guess.
One of the things I liked about the newer ones, and again, flawed, very flawed, was I did think that the Thing, even more the character, even more than the appearance, but the actual characterization, I thought was dead on perfect. Michael Chiklis was, in my opinion, just perfect. I mean, he nails it in the way that, you know, Hugh Jackman nails Wolverine, Christopher Reeve nails Superman. I mean, it was perfect. Even showing him in the trench coat with the hat and everything. I mean, it was good stuff. I just thought, like, the way they made him look took a little getting used to for me. It was almost like they were going for the original, you know, early 60s thing where he looked like a pile of shit, honestly, literally, you know?
Right. Right, like he did. Yeah, that's right. The design of the Thing didn't really kind of get that kind of symmetrical look to the plates until probably until like the 80s.
I guess, or not,
like in those early books, it just kind of looks like he's like a pile of rocks.
Yeah. I mean, you know, but I forgave it because I thought he just did such a good job in that thing. But you know, it's interesting too. To get back to the whole horror comics thing before we, I guess, wrap it up, is that Marvel seemed to really be the company that was in tune with that whole sensibility way more than DC. Because even going back to the 60s and a lot of the characters and things they tried, it always, well, a lot of times, it bordered on horror, if you think about it. I mean, you know, Fantastic Four has they actually have a monster on the team, for lack of a better word. You know, Doctor Strange borders on horror. I mean, they really kind of pushed the boundaries into horror a lot more than DC certainly did.
Yeah, I think the main difference between the two was that Marvel, really sort of beginning in 1961, was coming up with entirely original characters. I mean, they had a couple of characters that they had kind of absorbed from, like, when they were Timely Comics. I think they were called Atlas at another time, and they had an entirely different stable, like the zombie, what's his name?
You're talking about the Gravedigger character?
Simon Garth, of the Zombie, was actually like a book from the 50s. But mostly Marvel's comics were original creations, and DC was really just sort of continuing the stories from the Golden Age, because they were all books from Fawcett and Charlton.
And I can never understand the hole that DC dug themselves into. And I mean, only kind of the old school comics fans will appreciate this. But I mean, they dug themselves into such a hole when they reinvented all these Golden Age characters, you know, in the Silver Age. But instead of just what they should have done, which is just ignore the previous continuity, they felt this need to include the previous incarnations of all the characters.
Oh, I know. Following their Crisis on Infinite Earth, all of a sudden you got two Flashes running around and three Green Lanterns.
It was chaotic. Yeah, just chaotic. Yeah. They should have just, you know, pulled that whole retcon thing and just, you know, well, this is now the Flash. And there was never another Flash, and that's it. You know, I actually ran into Julie Schwartz at a horror convention. The guy must have been about 197 years old. He was the guy at DC Comics who was responsible for doing all that in the 50s. And I was almost tempted to walk over to him, but he was just so old, and just be like, what possessed you to do this, to create multiple versions of all these characters?
Like, and confuse, this question again.
Confuse all these poor children who are just trying to read comics.
I know, I can't keep the characters straight. Like, these days, I'm actually a DC guy. I can't really find it in myself to spend money on Marvel Comics.
But, well, DC, in the past 10 years, DC has stepped up the game. And, I mean, I always said when I was buying in the 80s and 90s mainly, Marvel was always, to me, way better. I mean, I only really read Batman and Superman. But Marvel was way better. But the thing that DC always had over them, in my opinion, was graphic novels. They did some amazing work, especially, obviously, the Batman ones.
Right,
but I mean,
right.
Amazing stuff. But it almost seems like now it's kind of all switched around, whereas I guess ever since maybe the identity crisis thing and all that kind of stuff, DC has just really taken over. They really have fulfilled the potential. I mean, they have the most recognizable characters in the world, and they're finally doing interesting things with them, and Marvel seems to be lagging behind for the first time.
Yeah, well, Marvel seems to have put all of their eggs in the mutant basket.
Oh, that's been going on for a long time.
Yeah, I mean, I gave up on mutants in the very early 90s. I the last book I ever bought was an Uncanny X-Men that had like a double gatefold cover, and the entire issue, it was a double size issue. It was dedicated to the wedding of Jean Grey and Cyclops, and it was just like hokey jokes and like embarrassing activities at the reception. Like, I'm like, I spent $3 on this comic, and it's a wedding. I'm like, I can't believe what I've just done. I was so ashamed of myself.
They lost me when they relaunched like the new X-Men book in the early 90s, where it was
blue and gold.
Yeah, with all the, you know, and you had all these different X-Men teams, and I forget who was it Jim Lee, I think, maybe, who, when they did the new X-Men book, the book that's now Extreme X-Men or something like that, or they said no, it's called New X-Men now.
Yeah, I can't even keep track.
That's when I kind of stopped, and they were doing, Marvel was getting caught up in all the gimmickry with the gatefold covers and the hologram covers and the variant covers, and I just sort of gave up, and I didn't start collecting again for years. But I'm sort of
that
out
was the
of
thing.
Now.
Is I went underground about that point. I really started reading indie books, and the stuff I was reading wasn't even remotely horror related or even superhero related. Like I was reading 8-Ball at yeah. that time. Like I was just like I was so disgusted with what was happening, and nothing was really going on at DC either at the time. I mean, they had the Vertigo line was really sort of in full swing at this time, but I was still like a little too young to really kind of latch on to that. Like I caught on to Vertigo when I hit like when I was like 20.
Yeah. Yeah. And they had Dead Man, which is another great horror character.
Dead Man's a great book.
Did
the
a
whole,
lot with him.
The whole Sandman thing, basically anything Neil Gaiman was involved
oh,
in.
Oh God. Yeah.
I
how
was
could
like
you not?
Immediately on top of.
That's true. Yeah. I mean, his stuff too, had a huge, I think, effect on making horror-related comics a bit more acceptable, you know, and now they like I said, I really feel like they're more prominent than they've been in a really really long time, and you know, I think it's pretty cool, especially when you get stuff like Walking Dead out of it.
Right, right. I mean, that's really the irony of it is a lot of the guys who were doing the very sophisticated stuff for DC were frequently pointing back to the horror books that they were reading in the 70s from Marvel.
Yeah, and that, you know, that takes us back to what started me on this whole thing, which is that getting that collected Man-Thing book. I mean, I put it down because I started reading a few other things, and I'm gonna get back to it and finish it. But I mean, there were a couple of months there where I was just totally obsessed. I'm gonna say this phrase, but I was totally obsessed with Man-Thing for for a couple of months. That's just the oldest joke in comics, but for months, I mean, like, because like you said, I did not even realize how well written and how well drawn the book was, but especially the writing more than anything else. It just blew me away that such a relatively obscure Marvel book, definitely not an A-list book, would have such high quality. And I guess that's kind of why I wanted to talk about all this stuff, because it had just bowled me over, you know?
Well, that was the thing, I think, with a lot of those B-list books is what they were doing was they would take their young new guys and they would stick them on these books that they expected to last maybe 6 issues.
Yeah.
And so you were getting basically the vital young talent that was just showing up at Marvel working on these really offbeat books. And these guys brought their A games to it because they wanted to succeed in comics. And it was just this unusual combination that like was just a winning formula pretty much throughout the entire decade.
Yeah, I think that's what it was. Like you said, it was real, a lot of these people really trying to show what they could do, regardless of the fact of whether they had a huge readership or not. You know, but I mean, we benefit now from it because look, if you're listening to this and you get anything out of this, it should be that you need to hunt down some of this stuff because it's all. I mean, tons of it are available.
Everything, pretty much everything from the era that we're talking about is available
yes.
in a series, a line of Marvel books called Essentials. And they're like phone book size volumes of comics that are not colored. They're all in black and white. There's usually like 30 issues to a book, and it's not always in continuity. It'll be like if you get like Tomb of Dracula, you'll get 3 volumes of Tomb of Dracula. You'll get the entire run of the comic, and then like appearances in Avengers and like Tales to Astonish.
Yeah. So.
And all of these, like even Monster of Frankenstein and Tales of the Zombie, I think there's even one that's dead. There's a whole hard, like double hardcover edition that's dedicated to Howard the Duck. I mean,
yes,
they really
is.
Have left nothing out with that line. Like, if you don't really care about the presentation, you just want to read some really great comics. Those Essentials books are fantastic.
Yeah, that's the thing. If you can get past the color not being in there, and I mean, you know, it is a loss because I've seen some of the old back issues with color, and it does add a lot, especially with something like Man-Thing, which is so atmospheric. But if you get past that, I mean, you know, it really is engrossing stuff, and the art itself, even without the color, is pretty amazing. So, I mean, the Essential series in general is the way to go if you're looking to kind of get into all this old school Marvel stuff. But, I mean, it's definitely a favorite.
That's the thing is they're also really cheap. Like everybody is hopping on this. I know DC is doing it now, and Warren even published I think the complete Vampirella.
Yeah,
in the same format.
They did all the. I mean, they've put out all the creepy and eerie stuff. And I mean, God, I mean, it's just so pricey though. I really wish they'd do something. I mean, they put out all these
Yeah, those Dark Horse editions.
Yeah, you can't go. Yeah. I can't go anywhere near those things. I would love to pick them up, but I mean, they're all in these hardcover kind of, you know, prestige editions. I really wish they put out kind of like a Down and Dirty, because the creepy stuff. God, I mean, we didn't even get into that. We can do a whole other one just on that. I don't know if you're too familiar.
A podcast of pre-code horror comics would be fantastic.
Oh, the creepy stuff is just incredible, and I mean, it's so the original. You know, Dark Horse brought back creepy, and honestly, it's just nowhere near as good. I mean, they just can't recapture it.
It was really well. Those books, that was really sort of a lightning in a bottle kind of thing. Like, definitely. You just, it was like a time and a place. You can't reproduce it.
Definitely, I agree. Well, I mean, I want to thank you very much for taking some time out to talk about this stuff. I could go on and on forever about it. A horror comic, especially 70s horror comics, is just an obsession of mine. And you know, it's nice to. To, you know, it's funny because back then you feel like you're the only one reading these things, you know. So it's nice to be able to talk about a lot of this stuff that I think a lot of people out there really loved, and they may not realize how many other people loved it too. So
it's funny that we're all kind of finding each other right now.
Yeah, exactly. It's very touching, I think, in a horrific way.
So, oh, yeah, definitely. I want to do this again. This is great.
I agree, and I want to thank you again. It's Brian White, and the website is Cinema Suicide, which I highly recommend. It's cinema-suicide.com, so you can check that out. And you'll what I like the best is that you're just kind of all over the place, kind of like me. And I sort of like the not getting too specialized. I think those are some of my favorite blogs, the ones that are just open to whatever kind of weird quirkiness that they kind of feel like covering. So I do appreciate it, and appreciate you coming on here and talking a bit about our favorite horror comics.
Thanks.
Hey, take care.